Take a network break. After digging out from a winter storm, I'm recovering with a regimen of hot water bottles, virtual donuts, and very real beer. Thank you for joining us for this week's trek across the icy tundra of tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. And before we get started, just want to thank our sponsors. ExtraHop. ExtraHop is the leader in real-time IT analytics and a pioneer of wire data, the ultimate lens into digital transactions. The ExtraHop platform provides insight across the IT environment, from the data center to edge devices to the cloud, helping IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. If you tweet at ExtraHop and mention Packet Pushers, you can get a free t-shirt. This episode of Network Break is also being brought to you by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. All right, story one. Programmable silicon gets a new competitor. There's a startup called Innovium. They've announced they're developing a programmable chipset for data center switches. This chipset is called Teralynx, and Innovium says it will offer throughput of up to 12.8 terabits per second.
The new fastest silicon in the market.
Yeah.
Sorry. There's always another faster one, isn't it? They all claim to be the best at something. It's always a bit of a mystery how much best there is in the world.
Well, everybody gets to be best at something.
That's apparently right. They give a medal out for everybody who tries. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's where we're going, yeah.
Okay. Well, these guys get a medal for having very large numbers. Innovium is not shipping, but it's announcing a chip that they've been 2 years in production. They are very fast. Let me cover off some politics first, because I think the politics of this chip market is quite interesting. There's a history of this. Is about a year ago, this company was set up, and then Broadcom instantly sicked the lawyers on.
Right.
Because many of these people are ex-Broadcom employees.
Two of the three founders come from Broadcom, yeah, and one comes from Cavium.
That's right. And then you go further down the food chain and it's full of Cisco, Juniper, the usual, you know, people having a break from being at Cisco, Juniper before they go back, but more again on that later on. It is very interesting that within just a couple of years, like these chips normally take years and years to build and to create innovative silicon, if you were to believe our highly trusted enterprise IT vendors, developing silicon is like equivalent to magic.
Sure. It's a deep, dark art. Yes.
Yeah. These people can crack one out in 2 years with less than $90 million in funding. Innovium is coming to market. So $90 million is basically covering up to the first product release. Now, keep in mind that Barefoot, we talked about Barefoot Tofino a couple of weeks ago. They were talking roughly $130 million in funding to get to this point because they're announcing about the same time. Just as an aside, you do wonder why they're announcing at the same time, don't you? Of course they are.
Oh, I have no doubt why they're announcing at the same time.
Just to point that out, that it's funny how they seem to have come to the market around about the same time, because this is one of these products that you have to announce and get people to support before you make your first production runs. You can't ship it and then see if they will come. You have to definitely judge your demands to know how big your production run is in the fab. You don't want to commit $100 million to a production run and then not have sales for it. You know, much better to da 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 da. So the reason that they're getting their chip out as quickly as possible is very interesting. And notably, Cisco also shipped its cloud scale, or started talking about its cloud scale ASIC over the last 6 months.
And is that a programmable ASIC, right? Or has some programmability?
Yeah. So as best as I can judge, Innovium is a partially programmable silicon. Remember, we did a briefing with them and they were telling us, basically, it's a very fast ASIC. So it looks like a, you know, any other switching ASIC, you know, a Trident or any of the legacy Cisco ASICs, but it also has a processing or a programming engine in it. And so where the packets don't fix the fixed pipeline, you can punt them to a programmable engine to be able to handle some volume of traffic. So the Barefoot Tofino is fully programmable. What I mean by that is you can basically program it to do anything. The price of that, however, the Innovium people would claim, and I haven't had a chance to validate this, is that because you're going through all of these steps of processing, your latency across the ASIC is significantly lower. We're talking nanoseconds of speed here.
Sure.
Not significant to most of us, right? So I'm not sure that claims of outright speed are useful, but for some use cases, certainly they are. What Innovium appears to have done, or at least in my view, is they've got a very high speed, you know, 12 terabit plus ASIC, which is faster than most. But they've also put in a 100 gigabit pipe to this programming chip, and it can also pop out to the external stuff for programming. So like the Tofino, which has a 100 gigabit interface to go and talk to the onboard server in the side of the switch, Innovium's got that as well.
Yeah, I think they said it's PCIe, right?
Yeah, PCIe, it's still a LAN. So Tofino used a 100 gigabit interface. Innovium's doing PCIe. Again, with this, if you split hairs, PCIe is going to be faster than a network interface. I will argue with you about that, but anyway, whatever. I think perhaps the interesting thing here is that there's a lot of innovation going on in this ASIC space. We are moving into a situation where you actually may start buying your switches less than because it's got a Cisco badge or a Juniper badge on the front, and much more because it's got an Innovium or a Barefoot Tofino engine under the hood, in the same way that we buy servers that way, right? So if you go up to your HP server, your server person says, I want the Intel E5-2960XML because it does this. But over here is a server that does a different sort of thing and it's got a different sort of CPU. It's very possible that networking is actually headed in that direction.
Well, like Barefoot, Innovium isn't going after the enterprise yet. They're mostly focused on the massive data center folks, the cloud providers and the big telcos and service providers who have the resources and the internal structure to take advantage of this programmability. But I do think this kind of innovation will start to trickle down to the enterprise over time as well.
Yeah, because we saw 2 weeks ago at the Facebook/Open Compute project, EdgeCore announced that it had an XPliant switch in production and you could buy it today, and that plans were afoot for a Tofino OCP version to be announced. It's not like these are just dreams. They're not like Cisco announcements, which get announced 3 or 4 years ahead and then suddenly evaporate when customers don't like them. These people are actually going all the way into production. Now, there is one interesting thing here. Cisco, let's just take a look at the Cisco CloudScale ASIC. We don't know how much money Cisco invested to bring the CloudScale to market in their Nexus 9000. And it is predicted to be the ASIC that will be behind the Nexus 9000. My guess would be that Cisco wants to retire the use of Trident chips in its Nexus 9000 and run its own ASIC in there. Certainly in the high end, they claim that the CloudScale ASIC has got singing and dancing unicorn powers, which it does. It certainly seems to. It supports amazing things like tetration, which, you know, if you want it, is a good thing to have. But it's taken well over 5 years for CloudScale ASIC to come to market. Certainly it's 3 or 4 years later. It was originally, it would be fair to guess that the CloudScale ASIC was due to ship when ACI was due to be released, and that's nigh on 4 years ago now. Then all of a sudden they came out and announced that it was going to be running on the Nexus 9000, which was running on Trident. And then they had the extra chip, which would go on the back of that to do some features. And now we've got the CloudScale ASIC, which is pretty much where it would be. So I just want to draw the comparison that if you're a specialist silicon manufacturer, they're investing Innovium and a Barefoot are like in the order of a magnitude of 100 million and say 3 to 5 years to bring a chip to market. Cisco, how much did it spend on CloudScale? How efficient was it spending on CloudScale? How quickly can it innovate the CloudScale ASIC to keep up with the future pipelines of these companies? It's going to be very interesting to watch this, I think.
I have to wonder if I'm sure there's a hardware issue, but software may also be an issue because somebody like Barefoot, they're not trying to port an entire legacy software implementation on the chip. So maybe that's part of the issue why it takes Cisco a little longer because they've got some legacy software to deal with. Is that potential there?
Well, it's just the chip, right? So now that Cisco's announced the chip, it's putting it into the Nexus 9000. No, they don't. If Cisco is as efficient as these startups, Innovium and Barefoot, and the features that I've been able to dig out and have a look at, and there's not a whole lot of information from the outside. You have to be on the inside to get access to a lot of Cisco information. But the details that I've been able to dig out indicate that it's partially programmed, looks like the Innovium, and, you know, high performance. It's got some fancy features related to what they want to achieve with tetration in terms of inspection and visibility. But there's no guarantee that customers will actually buy those solutions, right? Because it's just as likely that people can go and buy, think tools like NSX or Contrail or other SDN platform, which give you all the visibility in the vSwitch. And that's enough, really. That may well be enough. And if you've got those features, do you really want to do packet inspection? And keep in mind that packet inspection is very expensive in terms of processing. You know, people continue to highlight the cost of tetration because of the storage and the compute power it needs to be able to extract value from that data. Again, you know, hard to judge whether those features in the chip are actually going to produce a return. So those comments aside, Juniper Trio has got the same problem. If these companies can produce silicon faster and more efficiently than the dedicated networking vendors at a price point that's lower than them, where does it leave them with their custom silicon plans?
Absolutely. And they've also got a manufacturing supply chain in the ODMs who can roll out a box fresh and ready for customers. Yeah.
That's right. Whereas if you're Innovium and you've got Amazon's buying your and you're producing and, you know, or Barefoot Tofino, and you've got Google buying several hundred million dollars worth of your silicon, well, all of a sudden that silicon shipping, it's being produced en masse. Why am I making my own chip? Why am I not just going to buy that chip and make the most of it inside of my infrastructure? And, you know, enterprise customers aren't going to pick up the cloud scale ASIC en masse and pay over the odds, you know, to pay the sort of margins that Cisco likes to make from these products or needs to make to stay in business with its current profit margins. So this disruption is real, right? So Innovium's Teralynx, very interesting ASIC, high density. They've got a range of chips, the 3.6, the 7.2, and the 12.8. This means that they've got a whole range so that you would have in the spine, you would have the 12.8 terabit doing 128, 100 gig ports, if I remember rightly.
Yes, 128.
And then you've got the spine, so the second tier spine, and then the third tier top of rack. You've got the different capabilities, and they're also using an Inphi SerDes. So they're using a gearbox SerDes. So the chip is not built with 25 gig IOs like most of the current generations of Broadcom Tridents. It's built with 50 gig IOs. And then they have a gearbox SerDes, which steps it down to 10s and 25s. Then you've got native 50s, and then you step it up to 100s. So there's some actually quite interesting innovation in the architectures about, you know, that Innovium's running at 50 gig lane speeds effectively, not at 25 gigs like most of the other silicon. So they might actually be one step into the next iteration for some of the other people. Hard for me to judge. I'm not a silicon expert. Probably never will be. But I think it's a very interesting development. You should go and poke and prod it a little bit.
Yeah, we've got links where you can get more details. We're going to stick with chips for story two, but talking about servers now, this is Microsoft, Qualcomm, and Cavium arming themselves. Microsoft announced plans with Qualcomm and Cavium to collaborate on data center servers built on ARM chips. The servers are being used in Microsoft Project Olympus specification. That's an open source design.
Isn't this great? Again, we've been very dependent on Intel x86 CPUs. Intel's managed to get into a position of dominance, largely through its partnerships with Microsoft and the massive investments it's made in the open source around Linux, you know, literally throwing programmers into there to help make sure that Linux was very Intel-centric. And now all of a sudden, ARM's managed to get its server-class CPUs out the door. It's been flagged for quite a while. Is this, I think, sort of 2 or 3 years they've been talking about this?
They have, yeah.
And people have been poo-pooing it and saying, oh, ARM CPU, there'll never be a server CPU. But now we've actually got a situation where it would appear that Microsoft is actually getting into bed with Qualcomm to go with some ARM CPUs.
Qualcomm and Cavium, yeah.
Yeah, so Cavium is, they'll be manufacturing the silicon. Cavium's had their ThunderX2 around for, I think, 2 years now. I think I've got an announcement in my folder where Cavium was talking about their server-class x86 for a while. So maybe Qualcomm is a manufacturing partner and Cavium is a design partner and Microsoft's buying with it. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't had a chance. Yes, I think that's what it might be. So Cavium is designing the chip, Qualcomm's manufacturing it, and Microsoft's consuming it. So it's a three-way partnership. Does that announce match what you've seen?
Based on what I read from Cavium, it sounds like they are putting their own ARM-based SoC onto this Project Olympus design. So it may be their own ARM chip.
I think this is about taking control of your supply chain and forcing it in a direction that you want it. I think the megascale data centers like Microsoft, and certainly the others have been in here. I mean, we've even seen Google talking about the RISC platform from IBM, the PowerPC, and saying, we think we could run workloads on the PowerPC. So part of this is that these companies don't want to be beholden to a single supplier. For their businesses, they can't afford to just say, we only buy from Intel. In the enterprise, we do that for simplicity, and the actual cost of doing business with single suppliers and the risk can be ignored, or it can be deprecated or pretend it's not a problem. But if you're Amazon, you don't want to be dependent on a single company to supply you with CPUs. So they're pushing on the PowerPC, pushing on the server class version of its processor to get some supplier diversity and make sure that they've got some sort of competition in the market to keep Intel honest would be the big thing.
Yeah, I think so. As well as the fact that ARM servers being lower power, if you're building a massive data center, your power consumption is a significant price point. So anything you do to bring that down helps. But again, I agree, this competitive pressure for Intel around price and technology development, developing a second channel makes sense for Microsoft and others who can take advantage of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even if they buy a small number of these, you know, like 1% to 5% of their servers are ARM, that's enough to create a competitive situation that would keep Intel as in the supply chain as. And don't forget that AMD Ryzen was announced in December. AMD, the Ryzen is their x86 compatible CPU. And the reviews have been coming in fairly strong for that, both in terms of performance and for price, so undercutting Intel quite handily, and people have been quite positive about just the reviews of the x86. Now, whether you in the enterprise will buy an AMD Ryzen instead of an Intel it remains to be seen. An Intel Pentium remains to be seen. But these big cloud providers can probably be looking at that going, you know, there are certain workloads where a big hot heavy CPU works for us. Maybe we could put some AMDs in there and get some more supply diversity. So this is another one of these stories where silicon gets easy to make. So people make silicon because the profit margins available from silicon are very attractive. And now all of a sudden we have supply diversity, which creates the hardware starts to speed up its iteration cycle. We're no longer waiting for the Intel TikTok. We're now in a situation where competitors can enter the market and start to iterate at speed and do different things.
Not only that, but the customer, like a Microsoft or a Facebook, can say, here's the design I want. Now you guys go and build it for me. And they buy in quantities that it makes it worth it for a Qualcomm or someone else to step in and say, sure, we'll take some of that business.
Yeah. And Qualcomm, no doubt, will have its sales reps out there flogging this stuff to somebody else.
Sure.
They're going to bet that, you know, getting involved here starts a new business line for them. And so I'm sure Qualcomm's knocking on people's doors. It would be possible to do this, right? ARM servers can certainly run Linux workloads. And customers may never need to know that there's no x86 underneath this, especially if you think about things like AWS Lambda, which is just running Python. If you've got the resources to rewrite the compiler underneath that to be optimized for an ARM CPU, your serverless runs exactly the same. What does the customer care?
Nothing at all.
So things are changing.
Competition is good.
So far, yeah.
All right, story three. Intel bets $15 billion on connected cars. Intel is spending $15.3 billion in cash to acquire Mobileye. That's an Israeli startup. They make computer chips and vision sensors for driver assist technologies in cars. And this technology could be a key component for self-driving cars in the future.
So very interesting here. The big thing here is that most companies have been investing in a thing called LiDAR, which is, you know, this ability to do laser scanning and cross between laser and radar, and you get it back. And that's how you build up the image of what's happening around the vehicle so that the vehicle can make autonomous decisions about it. What Mobileye did was went in a completely different direction and said, we'll just put cameras on the car and then do some really smart software to do vision sensing, know what all the images around the car is, and we can do it better. And I'm not smart enough to tell you what the difference is between LiDAR and vision sensors, but Intel's betting $15 billion on it.
In cash, yes.
In cash.
Right? Stacks of cash.
So the general stuff that I've read sort of says this is hard to understand as financially. This just appears to be crazy money for stupid stuff. But strategically, I think the point here is that Intel simply cannot miss a market transition that involves silicon like it did in smartphones. It possibly would not survive if Intel did not get into cars and start selling the silicon that goes inside of cars.
The car is literally becoming the next mobile computing platform, so absolutely Intel can't miss that boat.
Well, there are others. The car is one of. So what the smartphone is for people, cars to transport, they're going to be full of silicon. There's also a bunch of stuff going on in streetlights. We're talking about mobile towers, of course. Intel wants to make sure it's control of the 5G market, that it's, you know, we did a Intel IDF 2016 and recorded a podcast on 5G, and Intel's very strong about its vision of having Intel involved in the 5G market, not only as a server maker, but as somebody who's involved in the RAN and the standards and the software that drives all of that. I think you can see all of this as part of that process. And, you know, Intel is always at the left of the food chain. That is, they make the components that other people then go off and turn into guns and bullets, right? Mobileye is very much that. So if they can make sure they don't miss the car revolution and they're betting on a different technology, they've possibly might have missed the LiDAR thing. So, you know, who would you buy that's got a LiDAR technology and patents? But mobile, very much over into computer chips and vision sensors, makes sense in terms of Intel's business because it's about cameras, camera sensors, and massively processing the images of what's going around the car so that you can then work out the environmental situation of what you're in. So that's why Intel's into this one, in my view.
Yeah, apparently they had worked together, Intel and Mobileye, on a project with BMW over the last year. So this isn't, Intel's not just going in blind. And another important fact to note is that Mobileye has already forged relationships with 27 auto manufacturers, and that's got to be good for Intel.
Throw Intel, the name brand there, and the manufacturers, and yes, that's got to be good for them, yeah.
So Mobileye is essentially going to become Intel's automotive unit, and that will now be headquartered in Israel.
So in terms of starting up a brand new business for Intel, instant, you know.
Right. Instant business unit, yeah.
It's weird logic, but hey, there you go, you know. Keep in mind that the car market is probably going to split into two pieces going forward. You're going to be looking at companies like Uber or Lyft who do self-driving services, and it seems likely that they will own the cars themselves. or form partnerships with the makers to supply them with cars. So they're the self-driving services. And then we've got lining up on the other side is the more traditional vendors who see the short-term play around self-driving, self-owned. That is, you will continue to buy your car and own it, but it will drive itself. So you'll be able to whistle it up on a Friday night at the pub and it'll come and pick you up and take you home. So when you throw up in the back, it's your car that you're throwing
up. Fault. I had not considered that problem. That's going to be the next app. Clean my car. Yeah.
Clearly, my life is different to yours.
I do my throwing up at home, sir. Thank you. All right. I don't know if Extra Hop wants to be associated with this ad break, but hey, Extra Hop is a leader in real-time IT analytics, pioneering wired data. That is the lens into digital transactions. They provide insight across your IT environment, from the data center to the edge to the cloud. This helps IT leaders make data-driven decisions that enable them to optimize performance, security, and customer experience. For a long time, IT has thought of the network either as plumbing or, in fact, a problem. But with ExtraHop, your network actually becomes your biggest source of real-time visibility. That's because ExtraHop does the analysis first and stores packets last. This is what they call wired data, which encompasses all the interactions between IT systems and the organizations that rely on them. Wired data is rich, real-time, observed, and objective. Analyzing it at scale transforms a network from a transport function to the foundation of all digital experience. Companies like T-Mobile, Google, Adobe, McKesson, Netflix, and Expedia save millions of dollars and thousands of hours with ExtraHop, improving application response times by more than 70% and mean time to resolution by up to 90%. If you want to learn more about ExtraHop and try it for yourself, visit them at extrahop.com/demo. And if you connect with them on Twitter, @ExtraHop, mention Packet Pushers and you'll get a free t-shirt. ExtraHop, it's instant insight for IT.
Oh, it's good stuff. We did a big podcast on them just a few weeks ago. So if you want to get a bit of a dial-up, get into that.
Yeah, their CEO is definitely a nerd. You guys had a good discussion. So if you're interested, take a listen.
I'm not always hot on packet capture, but that's what ExtraHop does. And that ability to take the packets and then pre-analyze them for you actually turns it back into something useful. So yeah, check it out.
All right, story four, Google gets serverless with Cloud Functions. We mentioned Amazon Lambda earlier. Google has launched its own public beta of Google Cloud Functions, which is a serverless offering. It competes with the likes of Amazon's Lambda and Microsoft Azure Functions.
So Google, at their Google event last week, the Google Cloud event last week.
Google Next Cloud.
Yeah, announced over 100 functions. Did you read them all?
No, I did not read them all.
You didn't?
I didn't.
Gosh.
I guess I'm shirking in my duties.
Yeah, I'll have to send you off to HR. They'll give you a stern talking to. It was a little bit difficult to pick some features out of that were actually irrelevant. But I think this serverless thing is becoming very popular, that idea that you just write some code, leave it in a storage array, and then it runs itself. Mystically, seems to be the big deal, doesn't it?
Well, the nice thing is you don't have to provision a maintainer virtual instance. These functions just sort of pop up as needed in response to a trigger event from somewhere else. So presumably it saves you money and time.
Yeah, I've heard lots of interesting things. For example, there was a company who implemented a search engine. They found that doing the search engine on their own hardware was very difficult because they couldn't know when the search engines were going to spike and they would be building burst capacity just for search. So they just took the search function and put it out into the AWS Lambda or these cloud, you know, the serverless platforms. And that solved their problem. Apparently, it only took them 2 days to do the whole thing. So it does certainly have some value. Whether in the long term serverless takes off or not is yet to be seen, in my view. At the end of the day, running stuff on someone else's computer means someone else's computer is expensive. Also, performance varies, can be indeterminate. But now that Google's gotten into it, we're seeing Google catch up, get feature parity with other people's clouds.
That's the whole point. Yeah, what struck me as fascinating, one of the stories I read about it, is that the billing for this can be metered per 100 milliseconds. So we're talking about very ephemeral, very quick-lived services. That's frankly amazing to me.
Yeah, well, this is going back to Intel. Intel at IDF 2016 last year, we looked at Snap telemetry. And this idea of actually getting usage and consumption data from the CPU is now possible. So you can actually poll directly from registers in the CPU as part of your code. And so if a script runs, you can actually tell how many milliseconds, CPU milliseconds, are being burned by a given process. So that's not a software function. That's actually a hardware function that Intel put in there. Whether it was done in partnership with Google or, you know, with the MSDCs, who knows? But there you go. It's certainly something that's done in silicon, not something that's done in software.
That's right. And it must be odd for Google to find itself a runner-up in this market. So they are working hard to bring themselves to parity with definitely Amazon and hopefully Azure as well.
Yeah, the general consensus is that Google's technologically superior to everybody else. So they very much believe that containers is the best way forward. And for serverless to suddenly take off and leave containers behind might have caught them a bit on the hop, if you like. You know, this idea of just dump a script here and it'll run whenever it gets called, that's not very container-centric.
No.
And not very relevant to the way Google runs its business. You know, Google runs its business by scaling up containers in terms of the millions per day and stuff. So I do wonder if – we talked a little bit about Google sort of pretending to be an enterprise company. Google's got to get much better on finding out what people want and getting ahead of this curve, not trailing along behind after it's become clear that there's some demand for something.
That's right. And maybe with serverless, obviously it's out and available, but I don't know how widely used it is. So this is Google presumably getting ahead of a major adoption.
Yeah, I think serverless is one of these interesting things where there's lots of fiddling around with it because it's actually very easy to consume small. But I do wonder if how much large scale stuff is going to happen with I wrote a bunch of PHP or Perl or Go or Python and just dropped it on a server and let it go. And I mean, are you really going to run a project $1 billion business around that sort of stuff? I don't know.
I'll throw this in the show notes. There's somebody on Twitter I follow called Cloud Opinion who has some very interesting ideas about cloud. And he wrote a kind of satirical blog that looks at 5 years ago, an enterprise talking about cloud and, oh, this is weird and we don't have to worry about it. You know, an enterprise software vendor saying, oh, don't worry about cloud. We can do that too. And our customers will stick with us. Essentially porting that discussion now to talking about serverless is still a little out there. It's still a little strange, but this could be another one of those things that comes up and eats folks without them realizing it. So maybe we should keep an eye on serverless. I'll throw a link into the article. You can check it out yourself.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Story five, is Citrix looking for a buyer? Last week, Bloomberg reported unnamed sources saying that Citrix is working with Goldman Sachs to, quote, sound out buyers, including private equity firms.
So Citrix has one of those companies where you, one hand, you think, you know, thin client, lots of different business models. It's got good results. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with the business per se. But in the face of cloud, what happens when you start to shrink slowly? And do the investors, do the owners of your company want to start moving their money into something else, which looks a bit more interesting? And, you know, so Citrix has got its NetScaler, its thin client business. It's trying to get move into different areas around its mobility managed Zen app, sharing files. It's even got a sharing file. Got rid of GoToMeeting recently. So it sold off the GoToMeeting business to a company called LogMeIn, which I think was a move to sort of make the business more saleable by reducing its total size and taking out what was a very large piece of the business, very large, very successful. And of course, GoToMeeting now has to compete with Cisco Slack, with Cisco Spark, Cisco Slack, Amazon Chime. Of course, Microsoft's got their chat competitor out, their webinar type stuff. So it's going to be an interesting business. So you think that, I think that Citrix is saying, we have to re-spin ourselves to do something new. It's not enough to just be doing thin desktop, thin client, and server virtualization in Zen Server. We've got to start thinking about how we get into a cloud. So maybe somebody wants to fold our features inside of their portfolio. So hard to know.
Yeah. So I guess its most recent financial results, they posted $3.42 billion for all of 2016. That was an increase of 4%. But the outlook from management was, quote unquote, conservative for 2017. And back in 2015, Cisco got into a tangle with an activist investor. That was one of the reasons they ended up selling GoToMeeting, is because this investor was trying to squeeze more profit and margins out of Citrix. And that investor also now has a seat on Citrix's board. So that may be where this private equity push is coming from, if this is actually happening, because again, this is all coming from unnamed sources, so we don't know for certain.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it would be a stretch to say that Cisco's core businesses are under some sort of threat from public cloud as people slow down purchasing, and we've seen that across the board. The question is, what does Citrix do? Does it shrink and become focused, which is what it's done so far because it makes financial sense to do so, sell off bits of the business and get focused, which is what it is now. And that's what HPE is doing, getting smaller to focus, and that focus should allow them to bring down costs and increase profits by selling at a higher price and just focusing on a smaller business. Or do you do what Cisco does, which is you go out and start buying up business units and sprawl across the market, like keep adding tentacles to your enterprise? Cisco's been doing that. You know, it bought the AppDynamics, it bought Jasper, got into IoT, you know, bought the security business to grow the security, bought Sourcefire. So I think Citrix is going to go out there and shop itself around. Now, the question is, does it sell itself to somebody else and become a part of something bigger, or does it get chunked up into pieces and sold off in bits, and where smaller is better? I don't think it's clear quite where it's going to go, and that's why they're working on a potential sale process, says the headline.
Yes, potential, yeah. Working with Goldman Sachs on some ideas.
You know, do you chunk it up into pieces? Maybe, you know, we know that load balancers don't sell. Most of the companies who've got load balancers have turned themselves into security companies.
Well, it's one of these issues where when you're a publicly traded company, you're judged on growth. And if your growth is slow, people start complaining, investors start complaining. And so going private takes some of that pressure off while the company can take a little bit of time and figure out its direction and strategy. Maybe that's what's happening here. And maybe it's just an investor who's got a decent chunk of the company who's like pushing for their own private gain to get a sale out of Citrix. I don't know.
Cisco could buy them.
I guess they could.
Oh, seriously, like, you know, the Cisco's, you know, in getting going closer and closer head to head with VMware. You know, if you could get a thin client, thin desktop service, server virtualization strategy, and you get all of those management tools, there's a massive amount of overlap with some of the existing stuff. But it would let Cisco actually stand toe to toe with VMware. And they could actually then walk their own, you know, not be sidelined by VMware's NSX and vCloud Director and, you know, just totally say, we're in with the enterprise. We're not doing cloud at all, and go completely down on enterprise and private clouds.
Citrix Co.
Yeah, well, Citrix Cisco.
Citrix?
Cisco.
We'll leave the name to the marketing people.
Ciscix. It's not impossible because, you know, it's VMware is the thing that's preventing Cisco from owning customers. And it is VMware's NSX and, you know, their cloud software orchestration, which is disrupting Cisco's networking businesses. You just don't need the networking that you used to, because most people are continuing to tell me, you know, I was reading in Reddit again this week and in some Slack channels, and people are saying, you know, ACI is great. It's fine as far as it goes. It's not very useful because all of our networking is actually done in NSX, and it's far better for us. So why would I buy ACI? I'll just go down that path for a while. Whereas if you suddenly picked up a virtualization and, you know, they've already got the hyperconverged, well, this would take your hyperconverged up to the next level. So Cisco's a viable option, yeah.
Is this spreadsheet worthy? Should we put it on the 2017 prediction spreadsheet?
Can we go like could be?
You want to hedge?
Well, I can see why you wouldn't, right? At the same time, you don't want to upset your revenue streams by taking VMware on head-to-head and then putting you head-to-head against Dell. Because Dell's a customer, you know, and a reseller and a partner. And we haven't actually seen Chuck Robbins make decisions, aggressive decisions to compete. So we haven't actually seen Chuck Robbins do anything strategically aggressive, like go head to head or make a significant move or put his foot down and say, this is what Cisco is doing. That's very much been, you know, I've replaced John Chambers, business as usual, some incremental things. And we'll pick up AppDynamics, but that's really just boosting our IoT strategy. Well, the SourceFire acquisition's been rolling on. That was done before his time. He really hasn't done anything to take people on head-to-head. He hasn't sort of shown that killer instinct. You know, most CEOs only get about one, maybe two decisions in a year to change the way a business looks. Maybe it's his time to reach out and put his stamp on the company.
Well, I guess I would say their hyperconverged move sort of is a little bit of a finger in the eye of the whole VCE partnership.
Well, it's more of that we partner with everybody. I mean, we don't offend anybody and we don't stand for anything at the same time, right? We sell one of everything, a bit like the Walmart strategy. We've got lots and lots of stuff on the shelves. We're sure you'll find something that you want to buy from us. And as soon as you start taking, you know, positions like you buy Citrix and say, this is our virtualization strategy, well, then VMware starts.
Certainly buying a hypervisor would plant a flag and be like, yep, let's go VMware.
Yes, and thin client and desktop, and that's BYOD. Cisco got out of the BYOD market years ago and gave up on that. It gives them a load balancer, but maybe they just deprecate that or give it to pieces to F5 or something. I don't know, whatever. But it'd be interesting to see. I mean, the NetScaler SD-WAN strategy is certainly better than Cisco's IWAN strategy at the moment, and maybe that would give them something.
All right, so if this does happen, we'll just restrict you to a minimum of gloating.
I could see how it could work, but I could equally see that this is something that Cisco wouldn't want to do.
Sure, there's strong cases on both sides.
There's strong cases for, but I could see, you know, Chuck Robbins hasn't been seen as a risk taker or a market mover. He's very much been following the obvious moves in the market. So to say that suddenly Cisco should... This is perfect for Cisco. It's just the sort of thing they need to take control of the market. That's not what Cisco's doing at the moment. It's very much a, we don't know where we're going. We don't know how to win. So we're just going to keep executing like we're doing and make it efficient until we see where we're looking, where we're going.
Well, we've got one more sponsor message for you. It's coming from IT Pro TV. And Greg, tell us about IT Pro TV.
So IT Pro TV is 2,000 hours of high quality video content and training material that are streamed live or on demand to your favorite device and even on your Apple TV these days. Imagine that, sitting home watching computer training. That would be just how much fun. You can always watch them on your mobile device as well. Now, there's lots of different courses, cybersecurity analyst, Cisco CCNA, CyberOps, ITIL, if that's your thing, or Microsoft Citrix, across the board. And as I've said to you many times before, this is the best way to be as a networking professional or even as an IT professional to know what your colleagues are doing around you. So even if you've not specifically got something to, you want to know about, but maybe as a network engineer, you want to understand something about cybersecurity or Microsoft, how it operates, just sit down and watch these videos in your spare time. Maybe watch half an hour a day and get a good sense of how things that are adjacent to you work. And then all of a sudden you'll start to look smart. If you do want to go down the process of practice exams, you can do that. They have access to Transcender's practice exams included in the fee. And you get the whole thing for one low monthly subscription price and a no-hassle cancellation policy. So maybe you set yourself with a three-month subscription and say, I'm going to do this for 3 months and trial it out as you go. Because you can certainly sign up for a premium annual membership. It's normally $57 a month. So maybe that three-month trial is what 3 months is enough start. But if you want to sign up for a whole year, it's $570 normally, but a special offer. Try it free for 7 days and then receive 30% off the lifetime of your account when you sign up at itpro.tv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30 and that'll give you $40 a month or just $400 for an entire year's worth of filling in the gaps in your experience. I mean, that's a pretty great offer. Like I said, just watch the videos, even if you're not intending to train or certify or sit the exams. Maybe it's not even in your core competency, but you need to know what the people around you. This is where we talk about full stack engineering. You don't necessarily have to know everything. You just have to have some insights. You could sign up at itprotv/networkbreak. Use the code networkbreak30 to get $40 a month or $400 for an entire year. IT Pro TV, thanks for sponsoring the Network Break.
All right, story six, Oracle posts strong results. Oracle reported its Q3 2017 financials, and the big story is cloud growth. The company posted total revenues of $9.2 billion, which is just up 1%. However, their total cloud revenue of $1.2 billion was an increase of 62%. Bam.
So you've just, I mean, it's hard to take Oracle seriously, really, isn't it?
It's, yeah.
Yeah. We're going to, and not only did he actually did during the announcement sort of basically bash all of his competitors and say, we're going to be number one in cloud within whatever. And you do sort of expect your average CEO make ridiculous comments that like that or none at all, either of the two. There's usually no middle ground here.
That's, you're very right. They're usually.
But the flip side of it is that, you know, no one has more cash and the sort of focused leadership that could make this happen. I mean, Oracle is the one of these companies where you have the CEO who owns the business fundamentally outright and has the sort of the chops and the personality to say, this is where we're going to go. We're going to take over the entire world. The general stands up and says, charge the hill. And all of those blind salary serves at Oracle are going to charge up the hill and do exactly what he says, whether it's smart or dumb or whatever. You don't want to laugh too loudly because Oracle's just as likely to be crazy enough to give this a go. And it just might stick.
Well, they get the majority of their revenue from software licenses, on-premises software licenses, and that's a big chunk. It's over $6 billion a quarter. But that business is also shrinking. It fell 3% in this most recent financial report. So I'm sure they're looking at those numbers and seeing cloud and saying, all right, we got to do this.
Yeah, I imagine that they really do. And you do wonder if it's cloud as in we're bringing our hand-developed custom DevOps, you know, hipsters to the Oracle Cloud, or is it Oracle's now hosting its apps in the cloud, and you can call that cloud revenue.
Yeah, I guess it's a combination of infrastructure as a service and
yeah,
platform as a service. So a little mix of both. I think a lot of this revenue is actually coming from NetSuite, which is a CRM company they acquired a few years back.
In which case, that's not exactly a cloud renaissance, right?
No, it's not.
That's not Kubernetes and a billion containers a day. Or
no.
I bought a cloud business a couple of years ago, and we're finally getting some sales in that. You do get the sense that you could drive holes through the claims, but at the same time, you've just got to respect the fact that Larry Ellison has built a business in spite of everything, and he does have the ability to tell the entire organization to go and jump off that cliff over there and see how long it takes you to hit the bottom.
That's right.
So we'll see.
All right, story 7, Silicon Valley executive recycling. In our last episode, we reported Jonathan Davidson, who was an executive over at Juniper Networks, had resigned in an executive reshuffling. And this may be the fastest rebound I've ever seen in the job market, but Cisco has announced that Davidson will rejoin the company as a senior VP in the service provider business.
See, in California, you can leave. Usually what happens is you quit on the Friday morning and you're escorted off the premises at lunchtime, and then you could turn up at your competitor on Monday.
You still got your stuff in the box. You're like, I'm ready. Let's go. Give me a desk.
That's as I've been told. And I've also been told there are reasons why companies set up in Seattle and Boston is because you can't do that. And in fact, if you were to do that, you'd be in court the week after. So they actually have non-compete to do with the employment terms. And that's apparently, rumor would have it, that's exactly why EMC and Microsoft and Amazon are set up in those states and not California, is to prevent this exactly from happening. So, you know, one day you're working and then next week you're working at your competitor. Which one is better or worse? Well, I guess it depends on what sort of person you are when you're in charge of the company. If you think that employees can take your ideas and your thing and your company actually doesn't have much of a competitive advantage, well, then you go and set up in Boston or Seattle, don't you? I've heard it many, many times. That is literally why some companies set up where they do, is because they want to make sure that employees don't walk out with competitive secrets and use them elsewhere. Now, I'm not suggesting that Jonathan Davidson is doing anything of the sort. I'm just pointing out that in Silicon Valley, for most of us, this is quite a thing. We don't actually hear about it. Keep in mind that Jonathan Davidson was a Cisco exec before he went to Juniper to be bounced around inside of there and have limited impact. So I imagine he's probably happy to be back at Cisco, sliding back into an organization that is actually probably doing quite well. I think the service provider business over there is probably tucking along quite well. And as soon as the service provider market picks up, Cisco seems to be well positioned to get a nice uptick.
Yeah, I think he had a warm reception.
It's one of those things. I'm resigning. Okay, buddy, come on back.
That's yeah. First call was to resign. Second call was to say, hey, I'm free.
A tweet and then have a job an hour later, most likely. Right.
All right, our final story for this episode, a parachute of gold. CNBC is reporting that Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer may be eligible for a payment worth $23 million after Verizon completes its acquisition of Yahoo's operating business. It could be $3 million in cash with the remainder in stock. That is not a bad way to exit.
She can keep the stock. I can have the cash. But was it a couple of weeks ago she gave away $2 million to her staff?
She was penalized. Yeah, there was. She had to forego a bonus because of the hack. So she didn't give it away. She said, you know, hey board, if you want to disperse this to the staff. But I don't know if that happened.
But still taking home $23 million. As a CEO, now do you really think that the CEO of Yahoo's delivered that sort of value?
I cannot say.
I cannot say. Who knows, right? Who knows? And I'm sure that you've worked very hard, but to take home, I think over the time that she's been at Yahoo, she's taken out over nearly $150 million, which would arguably be as much as quite a substantial whack of what Verizon got discounted for some of the mess that's been left behind.
You're right.
I just don't believe that CEOs are worth this sort of money. No one is valuable. It's the whole company. It's the whole team working together. And as I said, CEOs usually only get one or two chances a year to actually make a decision which actually impacts the company. The rest of the time, sure, they work hard and sure, their egos just love it. They just love all that stuff about being at the top of a company. I mean, that usually should be a reward enough for them. But giving them $23 million to leave the business because they sold it, that just doesn't seem particularly right. But
I'm entirely with you that executives are way overpaid in this country, and I wish we could do something about it.
Not just the U.S., buddy. It's funny how the people in charge seem to be very focused very heavily on the people in charge.
They're very good at making sure they are well taken care of.
Yes, indeed. So we'll see how that works out. Yeah. See how it goes. I mean, you know, like fair power. I mean, she didn't have to really give away the $2 million and tell the board to give it back to the staff, but she's not taking any pain here. $23 million will give you another holiday home down in Florida.
Yeah, I don't want to pick on Marissa Mayer. I think most executives are way overpaid for not necessarily providing the value that they're being paid for. So this is just an example of the excess that occurs.
Yep, that's pretty much it.
All right, well, maybe next week we'll be out with pitchforks and torches storming Wall Street. I don't know.
I can give you a $2 scratchy. Would that help?
What is a scratchy?
You know, the lucky thing where you scratch off the rubber stuff and see if you've won.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
It's a deal.
I'll give one of those to all the people at Packet Pushes. That'll definitely be the same thing.
That's great. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, where can folks get more from you?
people can find me. I'm microblogging at etherealmind.com and also publishing content on social media, especially on Twitter and LinkedIn. Lately, that seems to be where most people are reacting. I'd love to see you there.
All right, I'm Drew Conry Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. Thank you to our sponsors, Extra Hop and IT Pro TV, and thank you to you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. Please check out our newsletters. That's Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find those and more fine, free technical content at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.